I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, all the way from Western Australia, multi-award-winning novelist Tim Winton on his latest book, The Shepherd's Hut.
Tim Winton has published 29 books for adults and children, and his work has been translated into 28 languages. He has won the Miles Franklin Award 4 times and twice been shortlisted for the Booker Prize for Riders and Dirt Music. He lives in Western Australia, and Tim's latest novel, which we're going to talk about today, is The Shepherd's Hut. Tim, welcome to Little Atoms.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Western Australia, I want to talk about first. It's that when you look at a map of Australia, it's that bit to the left that seems like half the country, and it's very, very big and very empty. What's it like?
Well, it's like a lot of things because there's so much of it. There are so many different kinds of habitats and landforms and landscapes. So the bottom half faces onto the Great Southern Ocean, and the nearest thing to it is Antarctica. And the top coast is basically in Asia. You know, it's the Timor Sea and faces Indonesia. So it's tropical at the top and very temperate down the bottom. And it's a big chunk of the island continent, and you know, it's quite lightly populated, even by Australian standards, which by world standards is extremely sparsely populated. Very short on water. The main city of Western Australia is Perth, and because of declining rainfall due to global warming, as Jared Diamond predicted 20 years ago now, that unless, you know, something drastic changed, Perth would be a failed state. And he was bang on. And now the Perth drinks desalinated seawater. So a city of 1.5 million people, if it wasn't for desalination, it just would be completely unviable.
And this book, the characters live outside of the cities. Mm. What's life like for people that live in these small communities outside of Perth?
Well, it's a sort of shrinking rural population, certainly in terms of in the agricultural areas, partly because of mechanisation. So, you know, the wheat belt, which is like there's the Ukraine and there's Australia when it comes to global wheat production. And that's been happening for, 100 years in Australia, but mechanisation's meant that there are fewer and fewer people needed to do that work. So it's lonely out there, and the properties are really big, the farms are really big. On top of that, you know, with the declining rainfall, you know, agriculture is more risky. So it's lonely, it's isolated, it's harsh, and put it this way, suicide rates, especially among males in that part of Australia, are 2 or 3 times the metropolitan equivalent.
The narrator of this story, Jackson or Jaxie Clacton, who is he?
He's 15 years old. On the surface, he's a school bully. He's almost a borderline sociopath, really. He's as tough as nails. He's been brutalised all his life. His father's a dreadful alcoholic. The local butcher, who's not averse to occasionally going out with a few rifles and a chainsaw and killing wild horses and then passing them off as beef in his butcher shop. Yeah, the old man's beaten Jaxie all his life. He's beaten and humiliated Jaxie's mother. So Jaxie's a kind of damaged, traumatised kid who has taken on many of the behaviours and thought patterns of his father. So when we first meet him, he seems profane, spiky, aggressive, but not unintelligent. And also he's, as you know, as the book progresses, you realise that he's yearning for something. And he doesn't have a very complicated language for that, but the word that keeps coming back is decency.
And his mother, Shirley, at the beginning of the story, she's dead. She's died of cancer. Jaxie had this very close bond with his mother. They both seem to stay in the situation they're in for each other. But she's gone, but he's still there in this stasis, living with his father, who he's basically, at the beginning of the story, he's avoiding. He's basically not wanting to go home because, you know, he knows what's in store for him when he goes home.
Mm. Yeah, and he's hiding under the local grandstand at the football ground and wishing that his father was dead. No one's ever cautioned Jaxie about being careful what you wish for, because he goes home and finds the old man under a vehicle that's fallen off a jack. And so the story really begins with this flight, really. Jaxie thinks that he's going to get blamed for his father's death. Everyone in town knows what the old man's been doing to him and his mum. No one's ever helped. And he knows there'll be no help forthcoming, and he thinks that the cops are going to blame him for his father's death. So he bunks off. He grabs a high-powered rifle out of the gun safe, gets some ammunition, grabs a backpack, fills it with a bit of food, and then a jug of, like a water container that he fills up. And he just bolts and goes out into the bush. He keeps walking out through the wheat country until he runs out of farms, and then he's in the gold fields, and finally in the salt country. And he's just living hand to mouth, literally. He has to kill animals to eat them. So he discovers that there's no romance in being alone and abroad in the Australian wilds. It's a very bloody business staying alive. You know, he knows what it takes to some degree. You know what staying alive in the natural world means. What it costs the natural world and what it costs the self.
And Jaxie, as I said, is a narrator. It's a first-person narration, so we experience this story in Jaxie's head. And it's sort of narrated from a position of, he's telling us this story. I was very struck by the sort of point in time. He's telling us this story from just after, literally just after the events that take place over the course of this book. Tell me about that decision to put it there.
Well, I don't even know if I decided. It just happened. But he's a boy who's never been allowed to utter.
Mm-hmm.
It silences everything. And language is dangerous. Utterance is dangerous. The actual terms that you're allowed to use as a boy, as a male, are very restricted. And so he's a boy who's just fumed silently, and he's always let his fists do the talking. But yeah, he tells this story, sort of blurts out of him in the wake of these often harrowing events, and one final very harrowing event that almost sort of unhinges him, but it also unleashes him, and he sort of spews forth this, well, in a sense, the story of his life in 200 and whatever it is pages, in his own scaly vernacular and you know, rough as guts, demotic. And, you know, he doesn't have very many terms, but he has a few colourful ones, and he just, he repeats them and puts them in different order, you know. There's a lot of effing and jeffing going on. But, it's almost as though he just spews forth all this hot feeling. And he's immediately, he doesn't even know who he's saying this to, but he's almost saying it to the world, to the universe. And he's trying to make sense of what he's just been through, as well as uttering a few aspirations about where he wants to go in his life, even if some of those seem a bit fanciful to the reader.
And yeah, despite, you know, he's narrating this story, but, you know, he doesn't talk that much in his life. His father as well, so Sid, his father, and Jaxie in succession are very sort of taciturn. They don't really talk or, you know, communicate with language with each other. That becomes relevant later on, and we'll get to when he meets somebody else who does talk. But he is narrating this book in this incredible vernacular. Where does that come from?
Well, I think, I've always been interested in vernacular language and surrounded by it. And when I first started writing back in the 70s, it's a tough thing writing from, you know, what used to be known as the wrong side of the wrong continent in the wrong hemisphere, to be doing that and then on top of that loading more difficulty on top of yourself by writing in common people's language, you know, from the provinces. You're making so many problems for yourself, you don't even know why I bothered. But I just like the way ordinary people speak, and the people around me. I came from a kind of working class background, and I still spend most of my time out in the country, and people are different. I mean, you know, the modern world has come there. People have mobile phones, people watching American television and speak fluent internet, and yet in some sense even the 20th century hasn't arrived. People have different thought patterns and speech patterns, and they insist on a certain kind of difference. And I kind of like the fact that they still haven't lost their, you know, their colourful vernacular. And it's kind of fun to write in it. It's an interesting challenge to try to honour that language and then to make it sing, to get poetry out of it, for it to be musical, even if it's studded with profanities and it seems bewildering to someone who doesn't speak in that dialect.
So Jax has gone out into this landscape, is barely surviving at the moment. Tell us something about that landscape. You mentioned obviously that, you know, Western Australia is a huge place, very different in different parts. Mm. Where Jaxie is situated, what's that landscape like?
It's generally very flat. It's once he gets out of the wheat country, which essentially used to be a great woodland the size of, well, half the size of Western Europe, and it was bulldozed and scraped bare in the early 20th century to make wheat paddocks. But once he gets out past the wheat country and once he gets past cultivation or civilization, then he's into truly wild country where there are animals. But it's stony, the very, very low and very sparse trees. And eventually he's into essentially salt country, which is these enormous gypsum salt lakes that are almost always dry, very hot, kind of blinding to walk and travel through. And very, almost nobody out there. But the interesting thing with a salt pan is that, you know, everything that's ever happened is still recorded there. I mean, you know, you can walk across a salt lake and a dry salt pan, and 10 years later go back and see your footprints. You know, particularly if it was a little bit soft. So it's a place where the past resonates and is still present.
I wanted to talk about Sid, his father, for a moment. Mm. So Jaxie's, you know, one of Jaxie's main preoccupations is he doesn't want to be like his father.
Yeah, that's right.
Lives in his father's shadow. But of course, as you've sort of alluded to, and of course, you know, we're only having the events of this story related to us by Jaxie himself. But, you know, he admits that, you know, he's, as you said, he's basically a school bully. You know, he's learned to live on his wits and on his fists as well. He worries he's becoming Sid, and there are various, I guess, like sort of symbolic ways in which that happened. Like they both have an eye injury, for instance. And Sid exerts a fear not only over his son and his wife, but over the wider town itself.
Yes, such that he seems to be immune from any consequences for his actions. And it seems inexplicable as to how he could be this beastly. But he seems to be a protected species. He's very friendly with the local copper, and the only other friend in his life seems to be a bloke who sort of wanders in and out very occasionally, and they go shooting together. And there seems to be some prospect that maybe they were in the army together. And Jaxie never quite knows whether to believe that or not. To his mind, they just look like two old fat, hairy bikers getting drunk and shooting tins. But Sid's a sort of a monster, and as you say, Jaxie's terrified that he's going to become like that, and he's desperate to exceed his origins. He's very clearly stuck in the world that he's from, not just geographically, but, you know, and he's mentally. And I think when I look back on the book, I think what I seemed to be following was this idea of how hard it is to exceed the world you're from, and whether that's class or geography or the family dynamics, the dynamics of gender and sort of assumptions about what's right and proper behaviour for a man. And that's the thing, I guess, is that Jaxie's determined somehow. He doesn't have the language for it. He doesn't have the modelling for it. But he wants to be decent. He wants to be better. He just and he's worried that he's infected by his father. You know, he worries about genetics, and he worries he doesn't even actually understand the idea about modelling, really. And as a reader, you're thinking, well, what's the odds that a kid like this can actually exceed his origins? And I mean, as you say, we're hearing it through his mind and his language, but he does give away certain aspirations to the reader. You think maybe this kid could be something better.
Well, his main aspiration is to reach his cousin Lee, who he has, you know, a relationship with. Although, of course, also in this case, you know, we only know about this through Jax's impression. You know, we have no idea whether, you know, Lee has the same aspirations.
Yeah, so he's rolling the dice his entire existence on getting to Lee in this tiny town of Mount Magnet further north, and that she's going to be waiting for him, and that she's going to drop everything at whatever she is, 14 and a half or 14, and run away with him, you know, in a stolen car with a firearm, and they're going to drive north to Darwin, or they're going to go to Queensland, or they're going to go to Bali or whatever. You know, as a reader, you constantly, and you get swept up in his aspiration and his dream, but you have to remind yourself, this kid's 15 and he's unstable and he's armed and he's capable, as we discover, of doing serious harm to people. And so you're trapped within that consciousness, and you're trying to second guess him all the time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Tim Winton. We're talking about his latest novel, The Shepherd's Hut. And Tim, this is a contemporary story. You know, Jaxie has a mobile phone, useless as it is, out in the desert. But, I mean, it also seems like a sort of a timeless description of, I guess, a certain type of masculinity. Perhaps we could even say a certain type of Australian masculinity, because it's, you know, it's located in this certain place. Nowadays, perhaps we describe this as a toxic masculinity. Why does that interest you to write about?
I think because it's so resilient. I think given what the changes that we've lived through, or certainly in my lifetime, the cultural changes, the changes in government policy, the changes in popular imagination, certainly the changes in gender relations. When women have reached so high and achieved so much against the odds and against, you know, a great headwind, it's puzzling that men haven't progressed to anywhere near the same degree. And so just the resilience, the stubbornness of these tropes, of these patterns of thinking and behaviour that seem to be passed down from father to son, or uncle to nephew, from sports coach to junior football player or whatever it is. And also the way that's echoed and intensified by entertainment culture. Just the resilience of these ideas that many of us, or perhaps even most of us, are anxious to leave behind. They stick around. And I guess I've been writing about boys most of my life and men most of my life because I was one and I am one. And trying to puzzle that out, but also trying to give them their due, trying not to dismiss their concerns and interests because they're blokes, and if that's unfashionable, then, you know. But in this case, I think it's just an interesting moment. I mean, look, I wrote this book years before, the kind of recent discussions, but, you know, the same things have applied for a long time. And I guess at one level, you can understand that women have made progress because they're reaching for something that's been denied them, something that should justly be theirs. That's more access to power, more equity, more control, more respect, all of that, more opportunity. And they've done a great job at that, and it's been a fabulous thing to see in my own lifetime. In order for men to progress, it's almost it's not the same thing. There's not an aspiration necessarily that's quite as easy to describe and to make plain. Because really, in order for men to progress, it's not as so much reaching for things as letting things go, ceding power, ceding control, examining ourselves, examining our behaviour and our attitudes. And so, you know, it's always easier to get people to reach for things than it is to get them to let them go. But the only way I can look at it in terms of what is in it for men in terms of changing is that I think what we forget is that if men changed, our lives would be better too, not just women's lives, because, you know, this sort of toxic modelling of these narrow and narrowing ways of being a boy, and then, you know, which turns out to be very narrow ways of being men, deprive us and deprive our boys and our brothers and our nephews of access to emotion, access to language. There's so many ways of being a boy, so many ways of being a man, and yet we submit to these very narrow, enslaving ideas of manhood that seem to be something out of a John Wayne movie, and that impoverishes us. And if I have any hope that men will change is that they will see that there's something in it for them. It's the right thing to do because of the women in their lives and around them, but it's also a good thing to do because they're going to live richer lives. It's almost as though we all get given a box of pencils, if I can go for a really lame analogy. You know, we're all issued with, you know, a box of coloured pencils with a full range of colours. By the age of 10, most boys have had the reds and the yellows taken away from them because, you know, you don't want to do that. You can't dance. You can't sing. You're not allowed to. You can't hold anybody's hand. Hang on. They can't do that. It makes you look like a girl. Well, this will make you look like a poof. All that stuff, you know. So by the time he's 17, the kid's left with purple and brown and black. And he goes on for his whole adult life with all the colour taken out of his life. And then he replicates that. And then he has a son, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned obviously that, you know, the books obviously take a while to write, but this book does feel both very timely, but also, as I said, you know, a sort of classic depiction of masculinity. We've already mentioned, you know, we only have Jaxie's word on the idea that Lee is waiting there for him. But if she is, then we've also seen in this book glimpses of Sid and Shirley's relationship was possibly better in the past. So there's, you know, there's nothing to say again that Jaxie is not just going to go on in the future and replicate this pattern.
Yeah, I don't have a kind of a deterministic view about, you know, that people have to repeat these. And because life changes, you know, many people's behaviours are just a response to hardship, you know, and diminished opportunities. And you know, at a time in history, certainly in Australia, and I think it's probably, you know, not that dissimilar in the UK, we've got to this idea that, you know, if you're poor and unemployed, that's an expression of character, not a description of your circumstances, or it has nothing to do with your origins and the things that are acting upon you, as if history has no impact on you. But by the same token, it doesn't mean that men can't change, and that doesn't mean that Jaxie's doomed to repeat everything about his father. But yet, you know, what's the odds, really? You know, but I mean, in this story, as in life, you do meet people. You do opportunities do arise. You do get little moments of liberation that just come thanks to opportune interventions or just meeting someone or hearing something. You know, the world's not a closed system. And if particularly a kid like Jaxie, who is alert and vigilant to something that might offer him anything, he, you know, even though, you know, as Jaxie, as do we all, he gets a hold of probably the wrong end of every bit of information, but he does come away with something every time.
And so out there in the desert, Jaxie comes across this titular shepherd's hut, which is occupied and has been occupied for years by Fintan McGillis, who's an Irish priest who is, you know, living out there for mysterious reasons, I guess almost like a hermit. And he changes Jaxie's, you know, they develop this relationship. And I guess I mentioned, you know, this was going to come up later on, but the thing that Jaxie immediately notices is that Fintan talks. Mm. And so, of course, he's immediately suspicious of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just as Jaxie says, you know, people in his family didn't do their thinking out loud. They didn't do their talking out loud either. And yeah, he's very suspicious of uttering, and anyone who's talky, like as Fintan is, you can hardly get a word out of Jaxie, and the old man really struggles at first to get a word out of him. And the opposite's the case with Fintan. He's incontinent, you know, when it comes to language and communication. He's very talky, and it drives the boy a bit nuts. But they're both very suspicious of one another at the beginning. When the old man sees Jaxie, he's covered in blood. He's got a high-powered rifle, and he looks like if he hasn't just killed somebody, he's about to kill somebody. And by the same token, Jaxie pretty quickly figures out that the old man's a priest, and if the old man's a priest, then he's probably a pedophile. So they're like two dogs circling each other, and it looks like an impossible situation. And yet, I think, you know, the second half of the book is really about the fact that they form this unlikely relationship. And in a landscape like Western Australia, certainly in the interior, you can't live alone. You know, that's a European romantic idea. You know, people have lived in Australia for as long as people have been people, 60,000 years of occupation. And people survived that long and prospered that long because they did everything in groups. Like, you know, you travelled in a group, you hunted in a group, you did ceremony in a group, and art and dance, and everything about culture was group culture. And there's a richness to that, but it's also just a great pragmatic foundation because that was what was necessary. And both these characters, whether they realise it or not, are learning that lesson. You know, and in a sense, the country is schooling them. It's teaching them, in harsh terms, just what it takes to live out there. You need a relationships.
Now, Fintan, he's necessarily mysterious in the book. He's got this backstory that he never really lets on, and we'll come on to perhaps why that is in a minute. But what can you tell us about him?
Well, he's like he's been warehoused, and the Vatican does have warehousing facilities for anybody who's a problem, and certainly, you know, before the Royal Commission or the inquiry in Ireland and the Royal Commission in Australia, and I think there have been equivalents in the States and in the UK, before anyone was ever actually exposed and brought to account, they just would warehouse people, you know, for whatever crimes, whether they're financial or sexual. You never really know with Fintan, but he alludes to the idea that it might be a financial thing. Jaxie never quite believes him. But yeah, he's been warehoused there for about 8 years, and about twice a year someone comes out and delivers food to him. But he's there to be silenced. He's there because he knows something. And he realises that he's lived most of his life in bad faith. He's just been a procedural cleric. And he's lacked all conviction. And the presence of the boy is a goad to him, because Jaxie doesn't know very much, but he has very strong opinions and he's very passionate. And in the end, Fintan sees in Jaxie every boy. He sees youth, he sees promise, and he's full of admiration for Jaxie, even though Jaxie reads that as sarcasm. You know, he's always saying, you know, what a grand lad he is and how he's in awe of him, and Jaxie just thinks he's taking the piss, you know. So they're opposites at almost, you know, this loquacious Irish priest who has an education and who's come from a great world beyond, who's more comfortable with ideas, even though he's become very stale and lazy. He's had opportunities that that Jaxie hasn't had, and so the two of them are butting up against one another.
It's also, I guess, I mean, I want to come on to, you know, the idea of religious symbolism in the book, and obviously Fintan's a priest, but, like, you know, first of all, I mean, there's also an idea that both of these men are being tested by being out there in the desert.
Yeah, well, that's as soon as you leave the confines or the dispensation of the metropolis, you're outside of culture and back in nature. And the weird thing is that in contemporary culture, the real tests, cultural and civilizational, which usually means corporate, let's be honest. And the natural world is just background, it's backdrop. Once you actually get outside the pale into the natural world, the modern person is unprepared. And so literally the moment you get out of the car and step into the landscape, you're being tested without even realizing it. And the further you go, the harder the test. Whether that's a sort of a divine presence that's testing them, or just the natural world, just the isness of what's there. It just means that you're in a different... The terms of trade are different. And we have a kind of a skin of domesticity that we slide over reality. But it's not reality. It's just it's a skin. And when you get into what the real terms of trade are, you know, the earth beneath your feet, the quality of the air you're breathing, the availability of water. I mean, that's where we find ourselves at this end of history in the Anthropocene. And we've come to see ourselves as angelic disembodied beings. And there are people who are heading that way at a million miles an hour. They want to be more disembodied. They want to unburden themselves of their creatureliness. But what that's meant is that you think that you're the master of the universe. And our ancestors lived at the mercy of the natural world. And then after the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, the natural world looked as if it was living at our mercy. And we were so successful at that. The great irony is that, you know, we are now, and our children and their children will live at the mercy of the natural world in a way that our ancestors never had to. So I guess that's what I'm partly meaning by the terms of trade are different. As soon as you get out there, you're just being tested by reality, because you're in reality. This is a bit where the boy hasn't had a drink for several days, and he's finally found what he thinks is water. He comes upon a miner's shack, and it's got a water tank. The front door of the place was shut. I give a croak, but there was no noise from inside. I was still bricking it then, but I was mad for a drink too. I turned the handle and it wasn't locked. I pushed the door back, peered in. It was gloomy inside and it stank. I hoped to fuck I wasn't about to find some prospector dead in his bed with a face like a rat-eaten pavlova. But there was no one, and no bed neither. Just a wood stove and a cement trough, a chrome chair with no back on it, and a table made of milk crates and half a door. The dunny door by the smell of it. I shrugged me load and dropped it right there. I went straight out to the tank, and when I whacked it with me fist, it gave a long, thick shiver, so I knew I was in business. The brass handle was gone off the tap, but there was a vice grips rusted on the stem. That did the job good enough. Water pissed out on the sticky dirt. It looked fine to me, but could have been brown and I would have gone it. I got down next to the tomato bush and sucked it straight from the tap. Didn't taste that bad. I couldn't get the stuff down fast enough. I made noises I'm glad nobody could hear. If you've never been that thirsty, you won't know what I'm talking about. But I tell you, I drank till it felt like there was water in me balls, and me legs and me feet, till me belly was hard and me back hurt. And when I finally left off, I couldn't get up again. I sat up that night and fed the fire until I was out of wood. It wasn't cold, but the fire was company, and in the end I packed it in and I put me head down. I was still pretty wrecked and still happy, but I didn't sleep that good. At first it was the hard floor, then I got the gripes. I thought it was hunger pains, but it wasn't bloody hunger pains. I squirmed and rolled for a bit. I wasn't about to try that filthy, reeking long drop in the dark, so I put me boots on while I still had time, and when I couldn't put it off any longer, I ran out under the stars and got on with it. Christ, talk about bubble and squeak. I was in and out half the night, shitting like a duck. First I was worried about going out too far and stumbling down a hole. Later I was just glad to make it out the door. I had all night to wonder what it was. Sunstroke makes you puke, doesn't give you the trots. And it couldn't have been anything I ate, because there was hardly nothing to eat by then, so that only left the water. I never did think to check the tank before I started drinking. Could have been anything floating in there, some dozy possum maybe, or a crow, thought it was a swan. Whatever it was, it went right through me like a rifle rag. Come dawn, My date was so hot you could have lifted a spark plug off it.
So I've been talking to Tim Winton. We've been talking about his latest novel, The Shepherd's Hut, which is out now from Picador. Tim, thanks so much for coming in and talking about it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89Up, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.